Lecture S-27, January 31st, 1963. Lecture S-27, January 31st, 1963. Lecture S-27, January 31st, 1963.
Lecture S-27, January 31st, 1963. Field energy and field momentum. Lecture S-27, January 31, 1963. Field energy and field momentum. Lecture S-27, January 31st, 1963, field energy and field momentum.
It's clear that the energy of matter is not conserved. When an object radiates light, it loses energy. And so the matter has lost energy, but the energy is possibly describable somewhere else in the form, say, of light. And therefore, the complete theory of the conservation of energy is impossible without a consideration of the energy which is associated with the light in general, or in general, with the electromagnetic field. The conservation of energy law can only be described if we include the energy associated with the field. We've already pointed it out in the case of electrostatics. So today's consideration is the law of conservation of energy, and incidentally of momentum. Certainly we cannot describe one without the other, because in the relativity theory there are different aspects of the same four vector. So we have to discuss the concept of energy in the field and also of momentum in the field. Now, I'd like to point out that in our first lecture, when very early in the first year, we discussed the conservation of energy. We just said that the total energy in the world is constant. We'd like this time to extend the law of conservation of energy to something more in detail, which says that if energy goes away from a place, it's because it flows out through the wall. That's a little bit different than the conservation of energy without such a remark. Let's take the case of a conservation of charge first, because it's a little easier. We describe the conservation of charge by saying that there's a current, J, and a charge density, rho. I can't remember the sign. Let's see, when the divergence was minus, yeah. That when the charge decreases in a place, it's because there's a flow of charge away, and we call that the conservation of charge. And we say, as a consequence, the total charge in the world is always constant. You can't gain or lose charge. But the total charge in the world could be constant another way. Suppose that there's a charge here, and there's no charge over here. Now, as time goes on, this charge gradually fades away, and at the same moment, simultaneously as that one is decreasing, a charge is appearing here. And that charge at the end of the game has disappeared, and it's over here. And in any intermediate stage, let's suppose that we arrange that when half of this charge, or one-third of this charge is gone, then one-third of that one has appeared. Then the total amount of charge in the world will be conserved. That's a grand conservation, but not what we will call a local conservation, because in order for the charge to get from here to here, it has to have gotten through space without any apparent appearance, that's a heck of a furthermore, according to our modern views of the theory of relativity, distant points, simultaneous moments at distant points is not a concept which can be maintained. In a moving system, it doesn't look the same. For this kind of conservation that I just described, it's necessary that the charge disappears here, immediately appear over here at the same time. And one gets into infinite difficulties if you try to arrange that in the relativity theory. As a matter of fact, the requirement of Lorentz relativistic invariance has seemed to have made the possible laws of nature quite restricted. It turns out that in the quantum mechanical laws, we would like very much in the modern field theory to describe what we call non-local interactions, where something disappears here and appears there. But we get in trouble with the relativity principle. At any rate, if we do have a local conservation, a different idea, that when the charge gets away from here, it does so by moving, so that we can always associate with the changing charge another kind of a new quantity, the flow of the charge, and then have the flow related to the density, that's a different kind of conservation. It's a more extreme form. It's a special way that the law of conservation is maintained. We'll say it's a local conservation law, say, for a word. And now what I would like to say is that, as I've already argued from the relativity principle, that we can't very well be satisfied with a law which, it's bad to say what we can be satisfied with, because whatever nature would give us, we would have to be satisfied with. Now, let me put it more correctly physically instead of philosophically. It turns out that the conservation of energy is a local process, that there's not only an energy density in a given volume, but there's also a flow, that a vector that represents the flow of the energy through a surface. That is, as you can expect, when you radiate light, we can find the light here, then here, then here, then here, then here. And we could, if we imagine a surface, we could imagine energy flowing through the surface. And also, if we don't have any such surface, when the light, say, fields are oscillating over here, we could say there's energy here. Then there's energy here, and so on. So we have to describe how much energy there is in a unit volume, and also the flow rate. So besides the charge density, we have the current. And besides the energy density, we have the current of energy, if you will. So if we let U represent the amount of energy per cubic meter in a space, the energy density, this is the energy per unit volume, in the electromagnetic field, say, just let's talk about the energy in the electromagnetic field, which is what I have to worry about. The energy in the particles, you know how to calculate mv over the square root of 1 minus v squared over c squared or something. Then there will be an additional vector, which will be the energy that flows through a square centimeter per second. And it'll have a direction, so that if you put a surface up, say, perpendicular to the x-axis, S sub x will be the component of energy, the amount of energy that flows per square centimeter per second through such a surface, etc. Then the law of conservation of energy will be du dt equals minus the divergence of S. Yeah. Let me be precise here. Let me put the word field in here. I only want to talk about the field energy. Then, of course, it's true. It's not true. Because it's not true that the field energy is conserved. All right, you have nothing going on. Everything is dark. Turn out the lights. Turn on the switch. Then all of a sudden, the room is full of light, so there's energy in the field. There wasn't energy in the field before. This is nonsense. Of course, it's not a complete conservation unless it's all the energy in the world. And I'm not talking about all the energy in the world, just the field energy. So the field energy will change if there's some kind of work done per second per unit volume by matter on the field, or by the field on matter. Depends on whether you get the sign right or not. Let's see. Let's put it minus, I hope. I can never get this right. You stop and think slowly to get it right. Work done per second per unit volume by the field on particles, on matter. I mean, you know, sometimes the field pushes something and speeds it up, then the energy of the field must go down to agree with the speeding up of the particle. Yeah, the energy must go down if the particle gets speeded up. Maybe that's a little abstract, so we try another way of doing the same thing. Here is a volume, a definite surface inside, and there's a certain number of particles in here. And they are being pushed and pulled by the electromagnetic field. As a matter of fact, the formula for the force on such a particle is here. You know that. I just pointed out. So as account of those fields, there's work done on the particles, and their energy is changing. The total energy in the field, energy inside the volume, in the field energy inside the volume, is equal to the flow. Well, the changes with time, the rate of change, the field energy changing with time because it flows through the surface or does work on the particles. So I'm going to get those two terms. impact decreases because of dose to dose return. So the field energy in a volume will be presumably given by the integral of u d volume, and we have to differentiate with respect to time. Now, on the other hand, the flow, with the minus sign, then the flow through the surface will be, by the definition of the flow vector, the normal component of the flow times the area of the surface, you know, the normal to the surface times the area, something like that, over the surface of the thing. This is over the volume. This is over the surface. But now is interesting. His question is, what is the work being done on the charges? How fast is their energy changing? If a force is applied and if the charge moves through a distance delta x, then this is the energy change in the charge. We want the energy change per second. So if we divide by the time over which the change is made, then we find that F dot V is the rate at which energy is pouring into the particles, where V is the velocity of the particle. So a given particle then, for a given particle, the rate at which work is done on the particle, on one particle, is Q times V dot E cross V cross B, E plus V cross B. For a change, something simplifies. V dot V cross B is zero. That's nothing to it. It's Q dot, you know, so. So if there are many charges inside, I would have to sum over all of the charges inside, the charge on each one times the velocity of it times the electric field where it is. This is at the charge, this electric field. And this will be the working, now this should be the law. It's convenient, however, this sum is only over those on the inside. Well, it's convenient to represent that in another way. If I consider this a minute, I see that if I take a certain volume, if I add up all the Q's times the V's, that's the current inside, the total current inside. So if you do that in each little unit volume and so on, you can, after some thought perhaps, convince yourself that this is the integral of the electric current dot the electric field over the volume. It's the, each little bit of current from all the little charges times the electric field. However, the rule that we must take only the charges inside means it's a volume. It's a volume integral of the same, over the same region as the other side. So that's the correct thing that we have to have. And now, if we could only convert this to a volume integral, we could get rid of all the volume integrals. And it's very easy to do by Gauss's theorem. This is the integral of a divergence of S over a volume. It's the same as a surface integral over an area. Now we have a whole lot of volume integrals. Put the ddt inside, please, and take away all the volume integrals, and you're left with the thing that we're looking for over here. But in the meantime, we found out what this is. We can even write this in, j dot e. So what? It doesn't do us a bit of good unless we know what u and s are. And so what I should do is simply tell you what u and s are. And that would be the nice way to deal with this subject, because it took Mr. Poynting, who found out what u and s are, a long time to find it out. And so we just give the answer. However, it turns out that it isn't so very difficult that I can't disentangle this a bit and try to show you why, how you too, if you had lived in 1881 or whatever it was, could also have obtained the formula for S and U. So if you don't mind, instead of just giving it to you, I'll kind of half work it out. The idea is supposed to be, of course, that since this is field energy, the U and the S are not going to depend upon the particles. They're going to depend upon the fields, E and B. In fact, from electrostatics, we know that one formula for energy might be E dot E. Of course, the U and S might have depend on the potentials or something like that. But let's see if we could, what we can work out. So we're trying to find a U and an unknown S, which you could, which was a pure divergence here, three components of an S, which is a divergence, such that when we, these only involve the fields, and yet when we're all finished, we get J dot E over here. Well, that's a minus, yeah? Well, that's impossible. You can't just differentiate a lot of fields and then get a current. Oh, yes, you can. If you use the Maxwell equation, you see, the Maxwell equations tell us that the current is related to the field. So if we use that equation first on this other side, since J is equal to minus dE dt plus C squared B and so on, I get this. I get epsilon naught times E dot dE dt plus minus epsilon naught c square times E, well, let's say curl of B dot E. I mean, I just substituted for J from one of the Maxwell's equations. So I forget about this now, and I look at this. All I have to do is find a U and S so that when I differentiate it like here, there, I get this combination. So the game is to find the U and an S so that when you differentiate them, they'll produce the required junk on this side. Then, if it's done correctly so it does produce this, it's equivalent to JE, which is the work done on the charges, and therefore the energy of the world will be conserved and will be the right, and at least an expression that's possible for U and for S. So we have to just figure out how to do it. Oh, it's really easy. Look here. Here, what is this? Is this a derivative with respect to time of anything? It could be part of this. Sure it is. This is equal to epsilon 0 times the derivative with respect to T of E squared over 2. No, I did the 2. No, yeah, 2. All right? So that one means already we know what U is. It's just, in fact, the same as electrostatic. But now all we got to do is make this into a divergence, a pure divergence. And anybody in his right mind will say, you know the rules with vectors and cross, the dots and crosses. You can interchange the dot and the cross. So we interchange the dot and the cross. And there we are, all finished, because here it is, the S. And everything's all right. Only it's wrong. We made a mistake. See how smooth I can talk you into something, and then it's all wrong, huh? You can interchange the dot and the cross, huh? Well, we cheated you. There's a case we told you to watch out once when you're working with the derivatives, that the rules about the idea that the gradient is exactly the same as an ordinary vector isn't quite right. And the reason that there's an error here is the following. In this form here, the implication is that the derivatives that the gradient represents differentiates everything behind it, both the B and the E. That is, if I were to write it out at the beginning of it, I would have dd x of the x component of this, which I think is byez, minus bzey. That's what this side would start to say. There would be two more terms. When I differentiated this, I would get by dE sub x dz, dz dx, you see. Oh, also, ez dB dx's, and so on. Lots of terms. But the point is that some of them are derivatives of B, and some of them are derivatives of E in this formula. On the other hand, in this formula, the way it was originally produced, the curl was only on the B, not on the E. The differentiations were only applying to the B. So as a matter of fact, if I were to write this down, I would, of course, correctly, I would be taking part of this right. I would be getting all of these things right. But I would have been dragging in a whole lot of other terms. It isn't exactly equal. As a matter of fact, it's equal except for, I mean, if I add another term, then it is equal. In other words, if I cancel all these things out, which turn out to be, I think, we'll find out in a minute, B cross E or something. I want to write something that's correct for a moment before I don't leave this on the board too long. It happens to be right in this form, but how on earth would you find that out? See, this derivative is not equal to this because the gradients apply both to the B and the E. It's actually equal to this plus this. Now let's see if we can find out how to do such a thing honestly instead of just noticing that it's wrong. Find out how to do it right. And I'll show you a trick that I use all the time for such a thing. We want to discuss the divergence of B cross E, and we hope to express it in some other form in which the gradients are on each one separately. That is, ordinarily, when you differentiate a product of two things, FG or something with respect to anything, let's say X, then you get the f dx, g plus g df dx. Yeah, that's right. All right, thank you. dg dx times f. If I do it symbolically and forget about the d dx and call this an operation d, this operation d can do two things. It's either d on f times g, or it's f times d on g. Now, how can we make a notation that keep track of all that? You see, what our real puzzle is on the kind of two different people have made a decision on two different matters which have gotten us in a knot. The order in which the vectors are written is important in defining the dot products and so forth. The order in which vectors are written on a piece of paper makes a difference. A cross B is not the same as B cross A, and somebody has used the order on the paper to tell him which one he wants. But the order on the paper of gradients and variables is also used in another convention. That is, those things which come after a differentiation sign when the parentheses are usually all differentiated. So we have gotten ourselves into a knot in two different notations. So we have to get a way of breaking the knot. And there are two ways of doing it, is to break one of the two notations. And I will find it preferable to break the notation about that everything behind the D is what differentiates. Never mind that. Suppose that you were to write what the differential operates on. In other words, I'm going to make a new symbol. D sub F means that this derivative operates on F no matter where the F is in an expression. See, ordinarily, I write D sub F, FG. What I mean by that in the ordinary notation is D of F times G, or G times D of F, or anything like that. If I write F D sub F G, I still mean by this D of F times G. This D, wherever it appears, is a thing which differentiates the F, even if I happen to write it behind. In other words, to free the rule that where I put the derivative tells me on what it differentiates, I tell you what it's going to differentiate by putting a little thing underneath. This is a handy thing for you. I think that's why I'm spending so much time. I find it's not described anywhere, but it's a very handy tool when you're getting the complicated algebraic things. So, then, this rule here tells me something interesting. That if I have to differentiate an expression involving both F and G, if I have to differentiate with respect to both F and G, such a D, this D here, is really derivative with respect to F plus derivative with respect to G. That is, if you're going to differentiate more than one thing, you write the D as D of one plus D of the other. Let's see if it isn't true. Suppose that I want in the conventional symbol D of FG. Then I would start right out by saying, well, I have to differentiate both G and F. So I have it, really, it's this way in my new system of writing. So this new system of writing says it's df fg plus dg fg. Now df of f is already the regular, and back going back to the standard notation, it's df times g. But this one, differentiate only the g, so the f is out here and is in the conventional notation dg. So it's the same as that. So the rule is when there are several things to differentiate, you write your derivative as a sum. Now everything is going to be very easy to work out because what we want, what we really want, if we try to, for instance, calculate the divergence of B cross E, I suddenly break the notation. I say the derivatives may either be on B or on E. The moment I've done that, I don't have to keep the order of anything anymore, because I always tell you what it differentiates. I don't have to worry about where I write it on the paper. Under those circumstances, I can just use these as if they're ordinary vectors, numbers, and I have the first term dB cross E plus dE B cross E. And it's just as right as it can be. However, it's nice to be able to get these things back into a conventional notation so you can publish the paper. So, because nobody reads your stuff otherwise. Now, you see, you can do all the various things like interchange dots and crosses, and make other kinds of rearrangements. And over here, for instance, among other possible rearrangements is B dot E cross grad E, for instance. All kinds of things are possible. Looks freakish, but it's all right. Now, if we try to go back to the convention, the ordinary convention, this thing differentiates only the B anyway. So this is really the same as E dot curl B in the ordinary sense. I don't need the sub B anymore because it's the only thing it would differentiate. So that's one term. This thing looks peculiar, but it'll be all right if I can get the E in front of the other E. See, it's certainly also equal to B dot like that. Now it's in the conventional notation all right. I mean, it differentiates only the E, and only the E appears behind it. So that'll come to here. So that's the... there's the formula. I could have done it much easier in components in this special case and so on, but what I'm trying to show you is a mathematical trick that isn't appear very often, that's very good for unlocking the rules about the order in which the right derivatives and objects. That if you unlock those rules, you find it and do all kinds of things which you didn't believe possible before. At any rate, either by proving it with components, by writing out the components and checking both sides, or by any other method, including the one I've shown you, it is possible to demonstrate that the curl of the product of two vectors is also equal to this. All right? So by hook and by crook, we prove, therefore, that this combination here, which is this one, is equal to this derivative plus that. See, I made a mistake. It's minus here. Okay, so I've got this equals this and that. By putting this over here. It's minus in front, so it's minus in front. What did I do wrong? But I put it on the other side, and then I change. Look, how many guys have I got against me here? One against 10, and I still win. Okay. All right, even if it isn't right, you straighten it out yourself later. Now, you see, we're almost finished, because here we have a nice derivative with respect to t, and here we have a beautiful divergence to represent s. Only trouble is, there's a thing which is neither a divergence nor a derivative with respect to t hanging out. So we almost made it, but not quite. After some mental thought, we look back at the differential equations of Maxwell, and we discover that the curl of E is fortunately dB dt with a minus sign, so I'll flip it back again. See, from that one of those is the curl of E is minus dB dt. Ah, now it's a pure time derivative, you see. I don't hardly have to write it for you. It's epsilon naught C squared times the time derivative of B dot B divided by 2. So now it's true that we have exactly what we want, and the formula then is this, that U can be taken to be epsilon naught over 2 E dot E plus epsilon naught C squared over 2 B dot B. And if that's done, then the S, the flow of this energy, S, is given by the formula, watch out, I'm flipping signs again, epsilon naught C squared E cross B. So that's all I really want from you. I mean, that's all I really wanted. You can forget all the derivation if you would want to. This is the result discovered by pointing, and this pointing, as they say in Trinidad, vector is called Poynting's vector. It's a very convenient name. Now, and I make some remarks by giving some examples and so forth of this thing. But before I do so, I would like to say, you might say, this is not a derivation. Because all you did was find a possible U and a possible S. How do I know if I didn't finagle around with everything, I couldn't find another formula for U and another formula for S? Of course, my new S, my new U and my new US would differ, but they would have the combination du dt plus divergence S exactly the same as the old one. It's possible. It's possible, but the forms which people have, you can, if you work hard, you can find one, but they'll always involve various derivatives of the field. Up to two differentiations involved, like the second derivative or the square of a first derivative. And people have guessed that the most convenient form is the simplest one. There is an infinite number of possibilities, and the actual location of electromagnetic field energy in space is therefore not absolutely certain. But if you make the hypothesis that the world always takes the easiest way out, rather, the human beings always take the easiest way out to try to describe the world, then we'll take this to be the field energy and that the density of it in different places is given by that formula. This ambiguity has never been resolved. There's no unique way to resolve it. It is sometimes claimed by people that you can, in the theory of gravitation, resolve it by saying this. In the theory of gravitation, all energy is the source of gravity. I therefore must locate correctly the energy density of electricity in order to know which direction the gravity force works. But until we do enough experiments to find exact such a delicate experiment that we see the gravitational influence of electromagnetic fields, then we can't really make sure of this. And in the gravitational theory itself, there still remains the possibilities of adding terms of with second derivatives. Although it complicates everything a great deal, it doesn't make any difference where you begin. If you make the hypothesis that you end up with the simplest possible expression, it's always this one. So let's take it, because the rest of the world takes it, and so far nothing's known to be wrong with it. And it is, in fact, in my opinion, probably perfectly all right. Yeah, I think it was right to take the simplest expression in this case, and that this is a sort of one of those things. It's true that it could be something else, but I'll bet that it's this. Now we make some remarks about it. In the first place, the energy in the field per unit volume is very simple. It's electrostatic energy plus the magnetic energy. If we write the electrostatic energy as E squared and the magnetic energy as B squared. We've found these two formulas as possible expressions for the energy when we were doing static problems. We found a number of other formulas, such as rho phi and a couple of other things for the energy in a field, electrostatic field, which are equal to the integral of E dot E in electrostatic field. But in an electrodynamic field, the equality fails, and a choice has to be made as to which was the right one. Well, this is the right one. And the same with the magnetic field. The right one is E squared and B squared. And that's the formula for the energy in the field in the most complete electrodynamic case. And here's the flow. Now we have to discuss some of the little cases to see how it really works and see if it checks out with anything we know before. First example we'll take is light. Well, let's leave this junk here. Let's take the case of light. When we have a light wave, we have an E vector and a B vector at right angles in one direction or another. And E cross B is in this direction here. So this is an example of light going that way, I'm sure. I'll bet that the directions of E and B that I've chosen here correspond to a wave propagating this way. You know that the magnitude of B is equal to C times the magnitude of B is equal to E, magnitude of the electric field. In the light, and the electric and magnetic fields are at right angles, and therefore for light, the flow of energy per square, and so on, the strength, the size of the flow, energy per square centimeter per second, is epsilon naught C squared times, the cross product is just the product of E and B, or E squared over C. So this is the flow of energy in a light beam, except that the E varies as cosine omega t and x, and in the long run, to get the average S, the average flow, or the intensity of the light, sometimes called the intensity, energy per square centimeter per second, is the mean value of the square of the electric field times epsilon naught C, a formula which we derived, believe it or not, previously, independently, when we were discussing light in the first year. Also, we can believe that this is right by checking against something else. If we have such a light beam, then in the space, the energy density in the space is, according to this formula here, epsilon naught over 2 times the square of the electric field plus epsilon naught C squared over 2 times the square of the magnetic field. But the magnetic field is the electric field over C in the light, and therefore we have epsilon naught E squared, but E varies in space, and so the average energy in the volume is epsilon naught E squared. This differs by a factor C. The amount that goes through a square centimeter a second is C times as much as there is per unit volume. That's because light goes at the speed C. So in 1 second, that's much volume. C goes through a square centimeter a second, and we multiply this by C, we ought to get that, and lo and behold, it works. Now you can do some other examples. You can take an infinite number of examples, but we'll make some just a finite number here. One that's rather curious is to take a condenser and that we're charging slowly, not too fast. I don't want that condenser with all the high frequency, but I don't want quite DC. So I'm starting charging it slowly. There's an electric field inside. The radius of the condenser, say, is A. And what happens? Because of the change, there's an energy inside all the time. The energy inside altogether is U times the volume. That's the energy inside. And that's just epsilon naught over 2 times the square of the field at any moment times the volume, which is the area of the plates, pi A squared, times the height of the plates, the height between the plates, H. Good. Now we're changing the field. I mean, suppose we're charging it up. So the field is increasing. So in this volume here, there must be a flow of energy into that volume from somewhere. Of course, you know it'll undoubtedly come off the ends of the plates. Ha ha. No, sir, it can't. E cross B is the flow rate, according to this crazy theory. And E is in this direction, so E cross B would not be normal to the surface. Over here, however, E is this way, and you know there's a B. There's a B going all the way around this thing from Faraday's law. In fact, Faraday's law, is that the one I want? No, it's the last one of Maxwell's equations there that says that the line integral of B, which is B times 2 pi A, is equal to the flux of E, rate of change with respect to time, of the flux of E inside, which is E times pi A squared. That's the relationship, so that B is equal to E dot over 2 C squared. That's impossible. Times A, thank you. How do I know it's impossible? The dimensions weren't checking. Now everything's all right. That's the formula for B out here. So here's a B going into the border, E going up, and an E cross B, which we won't worry about the signs, but I'll tell you it's in going in along the surface. In other words, the energy flows in this way all the way around. It goes in. S is equal, because E and B are already at right angles, epsilon naught C squared times B, which is E dot A over 2 C squared times E. That's S. That's the flow. Now let's check whether or not the total amount of flow through all the surface checks with the rate of change of the energy inside. It better. We made all this work to make sure. But let's see. If we multiply S by the area that it flows across, it's 2 pi A going all the way around, times the height H, which makes it an area. So this stuff, multiplying this thing by 2 A H and so on, gives pi A squared E dot E. Oh, the epsilon naughts and the C squares, epsilon naught. This is the flow rate of energy in. This is the energy that's inside at any moment. If I differentiate this with respect to time, the rate of change of it ought to equal this. Well, the rate of change of a derivative is E times E dot, and 2 goes out. It's the same. Okay, checks. But it tells us a curious thing, that when we're charging a condenser, the energy is in the condenser, it's not coming down the wires. It's coming in through the surface. Screwy. Intuitively screwy, but true, as far as this theory goes. You might ask yourself, how does that happen? And I thought about it a while, and I answered the following way. Suppose that we had some charges up here far away from the condenser, and that we pushed the charges onto the condenser, because ordinarily they flow away. You have to do work to push them onto the condenser. How does the energy in the space look? Well, when the charges are far away, there's a weak but enormously distributed field out here. And then as the charges come together, the field gets stronger in this region. So you see that the field energy, which is way out here, those two charges working its way in. So really what happened, it is right, if it isn't even a condenser, but you just bring two charges together. The field, when they're very far apart, is over a big range, but relatively weak. As you bring it together, there's a concentrated field near, and the flow comes in from the outside. So although it is odd intuitively, the energy is flowing into the condenser from the side. I take another example, which I'll just describe qualitatively and leave, because I've got to leave something for them to give you problems on. So here's a piece of wire which is carrying a current. and then a long wire carrying a current. But the wire has a resistance. So therefore, the voltage is not the same all along. There's an electric field which is driving the current. There's a positive pole here and a negative pole here or something, so there's an electric field everywhere, outside too. So just outside, there's an electric field in this direction because there's a current in the wire. I mean, to drive the current because of the resistance. On the other hand, there's also a magnetic field in red, which goes around this way because there's a current through the wire. So there's a magnetic field. So there's an E and a B at right angles. And therefore, there's a pointing vector. There's a flow of energy into the wire all around. And of course, there's energy being lost in the wire. There's heat being generated. So it says that the electrons are getting their energy to generate the heat by the energy flowing from the field into the wire. Intuition would tell us, no, the electrons get their energy because they're being pushed and they make heat. So it's going, the energy should be flowing along the wire. Not so, it seems. It seems that it is not so. It seems that the electrons are really being pushed by electric field, that this field has come from some charges further away. And so these charges are actually pulling on the electron. And they're pulling, and it's through them that the electron gets its energy in order to keep generating heat, because if it weren't for them, the electrons would soon stop. They are maintained by being pulled or pushed by external electric fields, and so it is a flow through the surface. Finally, in order to continue to convince you that this theory is obviously nuts, I take one more example, and that is an example in which there's a charge and a magnet anywhere in space. Doesn't make any difference, but both static, dead, quiet. So there's E all over the place from the charge, and there are B lines all over the place from the magnet. The energy's not changing with time because E and B are static. Nothing's changing. Nothing should happen. But this dumb thing says that there's a flow of energy because there is an E cross B. If you figure out about that flow, you find it just circulates around. It doesn't change the energy anywhere. Everything which flows into one region, one volume, flows out again. It's like incompressible water flowing around. And if you chase, you take a simple example and just chase the vectors about, you'll see that is a circulation of energy. So in this so-called static condition, to take the easiest example, let's take a charged magnet, yeah? So that everything is this way, the field line. Then it turns out that it circulates around this way. It's circulating around on both sides. The energy is circulating all the time, getting nowhere. How nuts can it get? It turns out that that's correct, all right, according to this. There's no change in the energy, but it circulates. Perhaps it isn't so terribly puzzling when you remember that what we called a static magnet was itself a circulating permanent object. So here we have the electron spinning inside, an angular momentum in, or I mean rather, excuse me, a circulation of the energy outside. Maybe it isn't so puzzling after all. You get an impression, no doubt, from this, that your intuitions as to where energy is located seem to be partially violated by these things. This, however, is correct. Under those circumstances, you would believe that you must revamp all your intuitions, and we have a lot of things to study here. As far as I know, it's really not necessary. I might warn you that I don't believe that it's an important thing to notice that the field to a wire is through the surface, or that the way the condenser charges to discover exactly which way the energy flows. And the fact that there's circulation of energy in here is, in most circumstances, not an important point. So I don't think it's worth going crazy about the fact that your intuition fails. I have don't feel that you will be in great trouble if you forget once in a while that the energy in a wire is flowing into the wire from the outside and so on. It's not a vital point. In spite of the fact that your ordinary intuitions are wrong, I don't know of any cases where you get into serious difficulties. However, the next subject that we have to discuss is momentum in the field. And when we discuss that, we'll have a better understanding of some of these points. So the next thing I would like to talk about there's momentum in the electromagnetic field. We have to now find out how much momentum there is per unit volume. Let me call the amount of momentum per unit volume G. Of course, momentum has various possible directions, so that the G will be a vector, will be the momentum per unit volume. Better use one component at a time. Let's talk only about the X component of momentum. Certainly that's conserved, all right? That's all right. Then we should be able to write down a law that looks something like this. The rate of change of that G sub X thing is the derivative of some kind of a, it's like a divergence of some kind of a complicated thing, but it can't really be a vector because it's not a scalar over here. But it will be, the following would be the kind of law we're looking for. The rate of change of G sub X with respect to T is equal to ddx of something plus ddy of something else plus ddz of something else. It doesn't make any difference what they are because those are the flow of momentum, of X momentum, must be equal to the rate of change of momentum of matter. Now, the rate of change of momentum of matter is a force. See, the rate of change of the momentum of the field must check with the rate of change of the momentum of the matter, with the signs correct, minus. And the rate of change of momentum of matter is force. And the force on a single particle is QE plus V cross B. And if we add it for a whole lot of particles in a unit volume, the total amount of charges becomes the number of charges per unit volume. And the charges times the velocities up there becomes the current per unit volume. And there we are. Now the game would be to take the rho from the first of the equations and the J from the second of the equations, write out everything in terms of the fields, and then work like a demon to try to rearrange the stuff over here. So it's the derivative with respect to T of something, and the derivative of X with something, C of something, and D of something. We will not worry about the ACD, which gives us the flow of momentum, but only about the momentum density. We'll find out what this is. It's quite a bit of work. I'm not going to do it that way, but I'll show you that that's the direct way to do it. Instead of that, I would like to, at the same time, point out a very important theorem in mechanics, and that is this, that wherever there's a flow of energy, a certain amount of energy passing a square centimeter a second in any circumstance at all, field energy or any other kind of energy, whenever there's a flow of energy, energy flow per square centimeter per second, so it's an energy flow vector, then 1 over c squared times that energy flow is equal to the momentum in the space per unit volume. And therefore, in the case of electrodynamics as a special case, this G, which we'll never use again, is just 1 over c times s. So we don't have another letter for it. We'll just say 1 over c squared times s. The pointing vector also gives the momentum density in the field. So the pointing vector is not only gives the energy flow, but if you divide by c squared, also the momentum density. It would come out of this, that this is the pointing vector over c squared. But it's more interesting to notice this general relationship. And I will give a number of interesting examples and arguments to show that this is true in general. And it's not just a thing for electricity. First example, to kind of half convince you that it's true. Suppose that I have a whole lot of particles in a box. Let's say n per cc. We'll take a relatively low velocity. They're moving here with a relatively low velocity v. No, an arbitrary velocity. But n is the density as seen. Yes, they're moving, there's a certain number per unit volume, and they're moving with an arbitrary velocity v. Then the energy of each one, energy flow through the surface here per second, is equal to nv, the number which flows through the surface per second, times the energy of each one. Now, the energy of each one is its rest energy. Well, that's 1 over the square root of v squared over c squared. That's the energy flow per second. The number which flows through a square centimeter per square centimeter is this. And the momentum per unit volume is equal to the momentum of each one times the number per unit volume. Same thing. So it's true for particles. It's also true for light. As we studied light before, we know this, that if we have a wall or an absorber which is absorbing energy from light, and it absorbs an energy E, then a certain amount of momentum has been given to the wall. And the momentum delivered when energy is absorbed is equal to the energy absorbed over C. That means that the momentum delivered per second, per square centimeter, and so on, is the energy flowing per square centimeter per second divided by C. But the momentum delivered per second is the momentum that's in the light per unit volume times C. And so again, the momentum per unit volume is the energy flow over C squared. Finally, I give an argument due to Einstein, which demonstrates the same thing once more. Well, it's too bad, too bad. Sorry, I'm sorry. Suppose that we have a railroad car on wheels with a certain big mass M. The whole thing has a mass M. And there is over here on the one side of the railroad car a device which will shoot out. Well, let's say he took the case of light. But it doesn't make any difference what it is. You'll see it has nothing to do with what it is. There's some way in which, let's say, light flows. He was trying to show the relation of momentum and energy in the case of light. But you can show it for any relativistic case. Suppose that I take some energy and I transport it over to here. Let's say light. So we take an easy case. We take a certain energy W, and when we get finished, we transport that energy from here to here. The length of this car is L. Then, I mean, I turn on a light over here and I have a black wall over here, okay? Now, this car has lost some mass over here and gained some mass over there, and therefore the center of gravity has moved. Einstein doesn't like it that the center of gravity of an object can be moved from fooling around on the inside. And he assumed that it's impossible to move the center of gravity by doing things on the inside. So if we assume that this is the case, when we move the mass from here to here, the whole car must have moved back. That is, if the W is the energy that we move, W over C squared is the mass that we move, and L is the distance that we move it from here to here, then you can see, after some thought, that the car has to move back a distance x in the next picture. If the first picture had all the energy over here and not over here, and then the second picture, this energy was over here and not over here, then the car has to have moved sideways a distance x so that mx is equal to the mass that's moved times L. How does it come to be moved? He argued as follows, that when the light is emitted, there must be a recoil. Unknown recoil, momentum P. We don't know what the P is, but the recoil makes the car roll backwards. How fast? The velocity of the car will be the momentum which is given to the car divided by its mass. Momentum P is the momentum that was the recoil momentum that's associated with this object moving across. So the velocity of the car is P over M. Then the distance that the car moves is equal to the velocity of the car times the time it takes for the light to go across. Because when it hits on the other side, it gives another momentum and stops the car. So here is the velocity that times the length of time, which is L over C. Now we got to put this velocity in. We get x is equal to P over M times L over C. In other words, the momentum, we have mx would also equal PL over C. In order for the thing to work right, the momentum of the light, P, must be W over C, which we know it is. So everything's all right. The center of gravity is not moved. And you can This, from this argument, using the one I made before as the same thing as this rule, that the energy flow is always related to the momentum per unit volume. Finally, may I make a remark? You say, well, what's so important about the center of gravity theorem? I don't know. But suppose you say, I like better the conservation of angular momentum. You do? All right. Then suppose that we have, excuse me, that's a mistake. Suppose that we have a car that's moving by this way, moving in this direction past somebody who's standing here. No matter where it is, no matter how far away it is, the angular momentum around this point is the velocity of the, it's the total mass of the object times the lever arm, times the velocity times the lever arm, which is the distance to the center of gravity. So if I could move the center of gravity from here to here as time goes on, well, it starts out the center of gravity is here. But when I get to here, the center of gravity is there, then the angular momentum would be changed. And the angular momentum conservation and the theorems of center of gravity are closely related in relativity theory. So the conservation of angular momentum would be also destroyed. At any rate, it does turn out to be true. This is a general law. And we can use it in the case of electrodynamics to describe the momentum in the field. I'll give only two examples of momentum in the field in just a moment to show you that there is such a thing. We talked about the failure of the law of action and reaction when two particles were in that relative position. That means if the forces don't balance out, that action and reaction are not equal, that the momentum of the matter must be changing. It is not conserved, and it's changing because the momentum in the field is changing in such a situation. It's not a static situation, and the amount of momentum given by pointing vector is changed. Finally, another example is this situation here, which I've erased with my magnet and the charge, in which we were so unhappy to find that energy was flowing around in circles. But now that we know that energy flow and momentum are equivalent or proportional, that means that in the space out here, there's momentum circulating. There is momentum going this way here and this way here. There's angular momentum in the space. And you remember a paradox that we had with a disk and wire and charges. It's the same arrangement as this, in which we had an object which was not turning, nothing was turning. And then when we turned off the current, the whole disk started to turn. And the question was, where did the angular momentum come from? And the answer is, and if you have a permanent magnet and permanent charges arranged like this, there's angular momentum, circulating momentum in the field, stored up. And when you decrease the field, that angular momentum pours back into the matter and you see it going around. So this mystic energy flow, which at first seems so ridiculous, is absolutely necessary in order to maintain, because it's really a momentum flow, in order to maintain the conservation of angular momentum in the whole world. That I erased, you mean?
Yeah. Right, you say it's just got to go, this is the velocity of the car, V over M, now it's going to have to go over time, L over C, because the car is moving.
Right. I take the mass very large so that this velocity is very small. I'm only doing a first approximation. It's a slightly different, but the order of magnitude is V over C. I suppose the car is so heavy that it doesn't move relative to the speed of light very fast. You take the very heavy car so that the velocity is very small compared to the speed of light, and this is roughly right. You can do the whole thing if you would like to. It would be fun to try. Do the whole thing, including all the relativity. Don't make the mass so enormous. And let it be finite, and then do all the conservation laws correctly and see if it doesn't work with all the square roots of 1 minus v squared. The length of the car is changed and all kinds of things. It'll be all right, but I took the limiting case when I had a heavy car that didn't move very fast, and at the time is sensibly L over C. The next order is V over C, and those are just corrections, like relativistic, for the motion of the car.
What is the energy density formula if you have matter and you have a dielectric or a magnetic material?
That is a debate which we'll have to discuss when we have such matter present. This is the energy in the field. It always is. It depends on whether you wish or do not wish to include and call field energy the energy that's involved in distorting the atoms. Many people contain, they don't want to look at the atoms. See, in the early days, they didn't think about the atoms in the dielectric. When they put the field on it, it was just a field. So they had to have an energy which was different than this, because there's really some energy stored in the rubber bands which hold the electrons. If I add the energy that's stored in the rubber bands to this, then I'll get another formula. But I'd like to say that this is the field energy and the other is energy stored in the distortions of the atoms and is mechanical energy. So that's that debate as to what you would call a field energy. This is the strict definition of field energy, but for certain purposes of convenience, it is sometimes worthwhile adding the energy that's stored in the dielectric, in the distortion of the atoms, in with the field energy. You make a sort of a pseudo field energy that helps to make calculations. It doesn't really. It produces nothing but confusion. People have gotten themselves so balled up from those formulas, because you see, this energy, for instance, if the atoms have a certain resistance to motion, so there's a little losses and it turns into heat, and part of the field energy disappears because it doesn't return as you wanted it to. But this stuff is honest. The other stuff is confusing, and sometimes if you talk about dielectrics with loss and so on, the formulas always require enormous discussions because they're hiding the physical facts. So that's all. The formula in a dielectric is that the epsilon is changed by the dielectric constant here. If you want it. The formula for the energy stored in the field plus in the stretched atoms in a dielectric is the same thing with the dielectric constant in front. That's all.
Could you reproduce that thing you erased so fast right here when light is impinging on an absorbent surface?
Yeah. Well, you got it all here. 1 over C times the energy absorbed per second per square centimeter, say. Okay? Mm-hmm. Now this is the flow of energy that we've been talking about. That's the one side of the thing you were trying to prove, energy flow, right? Mm-hmm. This isn't quite the other side. This is momentum delivered per second per centimeter square, right? Mm-hmm. But it's light, and so how much density of momentum would there have to be so that in 1 second it would deliver this? You have to divide by 1 more C.
Oh, I see.
See, momentum in the light per cubic volume is, would of course, times C would equal to the momentum delivered per square centimeter per second, because it's flowing through, see? And so I just divide by 1 more C to get the relation. Momentum per unit volume is 1 over C squared times energy flow. Just a lot of C's to chase in it. I'm sorry about that. I raced it without thinking.
But they get, you know, you hear we have this new system now.
What new system?
They get a handwritten outline by
the
month shortly after election.
Hot dog. Look how fast he's got it already.
That's the 25.
Now, this hasn't seemed very consistent.
What?
I understand there's some confusion about signs. I heard about this,
Why?
But you have to work it out.
I told you that.
You zap, and you got this thing over here.
That's right.
Well,
because I also use this. Do it in 2 steps.
Yeah. The dot product number has this definition.
Look,
minus.
Let's do it in 2 steps. Where the hell is it?
Okay.
Oh, no, that's wrong. Oh, that's right. Yeah, that's the ordinary difference. So this one. Watch.
It wants grad mu, B mu, which according to the one law is grad T, B, T minus grad X, B, X minus grad Y in my sense, B, Y. I mean, these are in my sense, not the ordinary three-dimensional vector sense. And these things are, according to another rule, D, D, T, minus ddx, in fact I did all this, I remember.
Yeah.
Minus ddy and so on. And that's an annoying sign, but it's true. It's not, I said it was annoying, but one of the unfortunate things that has to be remembered, that the components of that various things is not the simple derivative, but minus. And these two signs make plus, and so it is consistent.
I understand that other physicists use ICT for the...
They get themselves in an awful lot of trouble. Of course, they can't remember whether it's plus or minus ICT in different places.
Well, isn't there also another really basic difficulty? And that is that in quantum mechanics, has a special...
I'll show you. If you just use ICT, though...
So ICT, all right. Now, what's the derivative with respect to T correspond to?
Yeah, but wouldn't it be the derivative with respect to CT, though, wouldn't it?
ICT, right? So you got that one right. That's fine. Now, what are the components of the scalar and vector potential? There's AX, AY, and AZ.
Right.
Now, what goes with the time moment?
IC five.
IC five.
Or minus IC five.
Maybe it's minus. And the same with J and rho, and maybe it's minus. But every once in a while it is. And you have this time to remember for which quantity is which and why. No, maybe it's not. I think it's just, it's all right. It's just IC. Maybe it isn't so bad.
I think that one.
Maybe it isn't so bad.
Isn't
the... I used to use IC two too, but the only trouble with it is that when you get to quantum mechanics, you've got a lot of I's that mean something.
Means something else.
They mean something. They really are eyes. This is just a gimmick to keep track of signs.
Yeah,
it's not imaginary. I mean, the time component isn't imaginary. You know, it's just a gimmick to keep track of the signs. And they get confused when you start to put those eyes together.
You need an eye and an eye prime to do it.
Balled up. It's rather annoying. And I made two eyes, and I finally gave it all up and decided to remember the signs of the relativity. Because that's an artificial eye, you see.
I guess as long as they're consistent, right?
Yeah, it's just hard to remember, but... You have to remember. So, it's just those two points. One is that there's a minus sign in the dot products, and the only other place that's awkward is that the gradient is rather awkward, that it's minus in front of each gradient. And I made that point very clear, so you probably will never forget that. And then, that's what.